Hello and welcome back to Mess Explores with Xavier and Alan. This week we're seeking perfection and breaking a few sticks along the way in Whiplash. So, hello Alan.
Hello Steve, and of course, hello to our favourite fans. Welcome back to Mess Explores. Before we callous our hands in lieu of perfection, our podcast is best enjoyed if you've seen the film prior, as we too contain spoilers. Now, Steve said, we are looking at Whiplash, which is a 2014 film written and directed by Damien Cazelle. Now, the film stars Miles Teller, J.K. Simmons, and Paul Reiser, just to name a few. So without further ado, Steve, let's get into the film. But before we start, guys, I'm just going to just tell you quickly about this fantastic desk that we're using. It's called Up-Down Desk, and it is a sit-down desk, and it is fantastic. They currently have a promotion where you get $375 worth of free value. So check out their site, Up-Down Desk. The link is in the description below. So Save, what did you think of this film?
To be perfectly honest, I liked this film. The sadist in me quite enjoyed
I bet it did.
My Teller getting chewed out by J.K. Simmons. That's probably no surprise to our listeners here. They know I can be pretty ruthless. I liked it. And I know this film sort of copped a bit of bad flack about the way that this sort of relationship was presented, about, you know, the sort of aggressive bullying, sort of racist, misogynistic nature of it. But by the same token, I think that's what the film was going for. I think it was trying to be overt in that sense, and that anyone that can't look past that and see what the actual objective of Fletcher was is kind of missing the point, because I feel like the film was being a commentary on this behavior. And if you're just taking it at face value, then you're not understanding what it's trying to say to us as an audience. I definitely feel that, you know, the idea of Fletcher and the way he sort of treated his students, you know, Andrew, played by Miles Teller, would I want that happening to my own kid? No, absolutely not. Do I understand what Fletcher was trying to do? Yes, for sure. And this relationship reminded me a little bit of a line out of Finding Forrester, when Sean Connery says, you know, something along the lines of failed people can either be great inspiration or very dangerous, or something to that effect. I know I've butchered the quote. And it kind of made me feel a bit like what Fletcher is. You know, had he been someone that's just never really managed to attain the success as an individual and therefore ended up teaching and is destructive? Or, you know, was he actually genuinely good and he's found a way to motivate people that is unconventional but really does bring the best out in them? So I think there was a lot of layers to this to look at that went beyond the sort of parochial, loud and boisterous, borderline violent nature, in fact, maybe outright violent nature, of Fletcher and his relationship with Andrew, because I think there really was a whole lot of depth to this, and I did actually enjoy watching this, even if it was quite difficult at times. How about you?
Look, I think this film was pure, unadulterated cinematic adrenaline. That's how I'll describe this. And this film comes out in an era where the majority of the films is radiated and refined by focus groups and marketing ploys to, you know, to sell at a specific agenda. But this film turns out to be very high octane. It's vibrantly alive. And the drama is about an individual who's sort of seeking this personal and professional acceptance. And I thought that just spoke volumes on screen. Now, the director, like he's showing the viewer his ability to sort of take a very dull and drab subject, like the relationship between a music student and a teacher, and he transforms it into this highly engaged viewer, glued to the edge of your seat. But he also talks about, or he builds on with this undercurrent of social commentary, like you just mentioned previously, about what it takes to make it in this increasingly complex yet competitive and cutthroat world.
I think there's sort of a deeper layer of commentary here too, and it's about, you know, what is actually required to bring out the best in people and actually find that greatness. And a lot of people are going, oh, this is a terrible way to go about it. There's, you know, less destructive means of which to sort of draw out greatness. And on the one hand, you sort of go, yeah, okay, great, you're probably not wrong. On the flip side, though, I sort of go, 2022, the West has kind of become a bunch of namby-pamby sookie-wookies. And this is sort of the point that I think Fletcher's trying to get to, particularly when he's talking to Andrew in the bar after Andrew sort of found him sort of doing a solo performance. It's like, to bring out that, you know, top 0.1% of someone, you need to push them well beyond what everyone else can do. Because if they hadn't been pushed and they were always told they're good, then they're just going to believe that, well, I'm good enough then. And they will never see that because no one pushes them to go further than that. And I think people miss this notion that, you know, somehow perfectionism is just instilled in some people and therefore they will be perfectionists just straight out the gate. And the fact of the matter is, that's just not true. I mean, if you think about this not as a case of a relationship between a music teacher and a student and just look at it as evolution. Evolution at a fundamental level is about the strong surviving great adversity. That's usually when the biggest leaps forward have occurred. And that's essentially what Fletcher's trying to do. He's trying to basically create a pressure cooker environment for his students so that only the truly good ones, the ones that truly have the talent, the motivation, and the passion, survive, essentially, to become the next best thing. Are his methods flawed? Perhaps. Is there their merit in the way he's going about it, though? Yeah, I understand why he believes his way is the right way.
Right. So you're comparing his teaching methods to a sense of evolutionary Darwinism.
In a sense, yeah. It's sort of like saying, you know, the greater the challenge or the things that confront people, that only the strong will survive, that only the exceptional ones will actually get to that point where they sort of achieve that greatness, because anyone else, anyone that was weaker or less focused, has dropped by the wayside.
Right. Look, so I'm on the fence with you here, because for the first part, I do agree with you. This film sort of explores how far one person is willing to go and what they're prepared to endure in order to push yourself to succeed, right? Mm. And I guess for mentors out there, how far are you willing to push someone, you know, to force them into that path of success or even to be in that 1% of greatness? And I think this film reminds me about, you know, that very first scene in Being Molly or Where's Molly, you know, about the Olympian athlete who ended up becoming a cars dealer, where her father, as she's skiing down the slope, he keeps telling, and she's like a child at this stage, she's tired, she's exhausted, but her father wants her to perfect her craft. And he keeps saying, oh, you know, you're shit. Only the weak quit. Okay, if you're weak, let's go pack it up. And then she goes back up the hill and she slopes again until she perfects it. And it reminds me of, you know, is this what it takes to be great? Is this the level that we all should be pushing ourselves towards to be in that top 1%? But if it is, should that relationship be bidirectional?
Well, yes and no, I guess. I mean, bidirectional, yes, because it's sort of almost a symbiotic relationship. The person that delivers the pressure can only do so long as they have someone that can stand the pressure. If, you know, the character of Fletcher always came up against people that could never achieve or succeed or surpass his expectations, then he would cease to be a teacher because he would never have any students. And I think what we saw in this is, you know, Andrew and a number of his peers, even though they knew that Fletcher was a pretty awful person, they still wanted to be taught by him. They still respect him enough. They respect his methodology because they knew what it took to become the best. And I think a bit like your example of, you know, the young girl going up and down the slope, unless you had someone to push you, you're never going to keep doing it. And this is the thing. Not everyone can be pushed to be that 1%. Not everyone can be that 1%. 99% of people, you know, probably a case of that'll do. You're good. That's fine. I'm happy with that. Because a lot of it actually comes down to the motivation of the person that wants to be that 1%. Not everybody wants to be that 1%. So they're not going to find themselves exposed to the likes of Fletcher that really wants to push them to become that 1%. And I think it is a symbiotic relationship, because to be great, you need someone to push you to be great. And I think that's sort of where this line is. And, you know, pushing someone to be great can come in a whole bunch of different methodologies and means and ways and pathways and avenues. But you've got to have someone that does it. And you're going to find someone that does it the way you need. And if you don't, you'll probably never achieve it.
Right. So I guess when we take this back to the film, we see Andrew, you know, his relationship with his girlfriend deteriorates. He sort of abandons his friends, his bands, etc. He becomes focused. He becomes shoehorned into achieving one objective, which is fantastic. But then it gets to a level where he can't meet the expectation of Fletcher, or I guess Fletcher's even demanding even more greatness, even more perfection, and that whole relationship becomes atomic and unstable.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not going to discount the fact that the actual relationship was, you know, embroiled a huge amount of conflict and violence and stuff like that, that, you know, is by no means necessarily a good thing. But I think, again, it's not about necessarily Fletcher's methodologies being in this film or anything else. It's about just, you know, the core relationship is having that person that will push you that hard to be the best, irrespective of how that comes. Should it, you know, involve throwing a chair at someone? perhaps not. I'm not condoning throwing chairs and cymbals at people, but I am saying that you do need someone that will push you that hard. And the thing is, you've got to remember that this wasn't a teacher pushing a student that didn't want to get there. This was a student that wanted to get there, was self-motivated, knew what they had to sacrifice, and knew there would be huge sacrifice to get there. And they'd found the person that was willing to go on that journey with them and push them that bit harder to get where they wanted to go. And I think that's sort of what the end of the film was trying to say. Yes. When Andrew comes out onto the stage, Fletcher throws him under the bus, and you're like, uh-oh, okay, Fletcher's just a vindictive prick. But what we actually saw was that Andrew went, no, I've learnt the lesson. I know how to be resilient. You've thrown a chair at me. I'm going to actually stick it to you because I am the best. You made me the best, and I'm going to prove to you that I am what you made me. And ultimately, you could argue it would be Fletcher's downfall because Andrew succeeds it. Now, that whole dynamic sort of goes a little bit deeper by the end of the film. At the very end of the film, you're like, oh, does he, doesn't he? Like, it leaves it a little bit open-ended, but it's almost a validation of Fletcher's styles, but it's actually a vindication of Andrew despite Fletcher. So it's a bit of that's still that symbiotic relationship, even in success.
Right, and I'm glad you mentioned the ending, because this film is carried by two amazing actors. And we recently did a podcast about Miles Teller in his movie Top Gun. So if you haven't listened to that episode, please go and check that out. But these two actors are able to sort of display this electric performance. And you're right, this film and the screenplay, it does sort of narrow itself down into a corner. And then by the end of the second act, that's what it feels like. You know, like you're like, oh, this is very predictive. He just got expelled. Like, this guy's been made to resign. And now, you know, this is going to be a predictable ending. But then the last 10 minutes or the 20 minutes of this film, it just took me on a crazy emotional ride, something that I didn't expect. Mm. And as an audience watching this film and looking at Andrew go through these emotions, you know, arising and falling, just like his hopes and dreams, you know, we also sort of make those climbs and crashes as the viewer. And I think that's just great filmmaking. And I can see why this film won the Oscar.
No, it really does bring you along for the journey, because it is such a simple film that does convey so much. And I would like to say too, the flip side of their relationship is obviously Andrew's relationship with his father, Jim, played by Paul Reiser. Now, I think a lot of people that complain about this film being about, you know, it's a terrible way to teach people and, you know, treat them and so forth, they'd probably also look at his relationship with Jim and be like, oh, Jim's a great father, you know, he's supportive, he wants to look after his son, make sure he's not abused, he's there for him, blah, 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 blah. But I think if you actually look at this film, it's saying that his relationship with his father is actually counterproductive. Now, Andrew knows that relationship is counterproductive, and so he sort of removes himself from some of those day-to-day relationship things with his father. And I think the classic case where we saw this was at the dinner table, where he's having dinner with his family, and I think probably some family friends, or maybe it's cousins or whatnot, I'm not quite sure. But they're sort of spruiking how good it is that, you know, these kids have, you know, succeeded on the football field and blah, blah, blah. And, oh, what are you doing? Oh, you're a musician, blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, pity the art student, and so on and so forth. And I think the film was looking at a couple of different things here. It's about, you know, what do we actually value in society? Do we value, you know, a bunch of dickheads kicking a sheep's bladder around? Or do we actually value someone that really goes out for a lifelong passion and purpose to achieve something that very few people could? And why do we not respect that? Because I think the arts always come second to the likes of sports. Now, maybe it's just, you know, the uneducated masses versus the top few that sort of have that appreciation of arts and society and those sort of finer classical things. But, you know, whether you do or not, I think it was really trying to highlight the difference between the two older men in Andrew's life. It was the juxtaposition. The one that seemed supportive but was actually holding him back, and the one that seemed malicious and vindictive but was actually pushing him forward.
I might have to disagree with you. I don't think the disconnect between art and sport is because of your intellectual level. I think it's because what sells in this current world is attention. And if you find a way to make a drab subject more enthusiastic viewing, it becomes marketable. And a prime example of this is F1 Drive to Survive on Netflix. Mate, I didn't understand F1 for the likes of me. But then you watch this bloody show, and all I want to look into is F1. But I only want to watch the next season because it's done so well. Mm. You know what I mean? So I think if a subject is marketed amazingly, to the likes and the talents of Netflix and other streaming platforms, you can make masses appreciate that subject. Now, whether or not we've got the time to do that, or people who want to invest the time into doing that, that's another story. But that last 20 minutes that you were talking about, that last scene where, and I think Simon Bruce sort of describes it best when he says, the last 20 minutes of this film is just a gripping experience. And that's what it was, because we're seeing Miles Teller's character, Andrew, turning up at this JBC festival. You know, he's ready to play drums again. And then you've got this coincidental reunion and invitation by Fletcher to come and play, right? And there's already so much going on here because time has passed. We've already seen how these characters have got here. There's uneasy tensions, and this has, you know, earned and been built up throughout the movie, and we can palpate it. And now the twist of this whole thing is Fletcher's invitation, like you mentioned before, is not because he wants to see Andrew succeed. It's because it's an invitation for revenge. It's an act of revenge, right? And this is something that, you know, like, it's all set up beautifully, and Andrew gets exposed on the stage. He's open to ridicule, and, you know, he's not given the music for the band. He's, you know, Fletcher whispers in his ears, and I think this is one of the most incredible final acts we've seen, because you're rooting for both these characters in two separate ways. As a viewer, you understand what each of these characters have gone through and the choices that they've made to get there. And because both of these characters, both Fletcher and Andrew, have sacrificed everything for their music.
Look, I agree. I think, you know, they have both sacrificed a huge amount for their music. And for me, though, this last thing, I think you can take that sort of final moment in two very different ways. You can say, yes, it was a vindictive thing. He wanted to see Andrew fail. And you're probably right. That probably was his initial intention. I have no doubt about that. But I think by the same token, coincidentally and unintentionally, it was also the equivalent of throwing the symbol at his head. It was like, let's see if he comes back. And it wasn't, again, something Fletcher expected or had intended. Andrew took that initiative and went, no, that's the kick I need. That's the moment where someone's thrown something at me and I'm going to come back and I'm going to show them what I really am made of. I want the world to see how good I am. And while Fletcher had always been pushing for this moment and trying to find the way to get that last little 1% out of people, it was this action of revenge that actually turned out to be the best lesson. Now, all the other lessons had built up to this, all the sacrifices that they'd made for each other and to each other and because of each other. But it was that final act of revenge that really pushed Andrew that last 1% and went, I am now great. And I think that was sort of what the film was trying to reflect, is that not every teaching is done as an intentional thing. Some teachings are coincidental, experiential, or just a byproduct of life. And I think that's sort of what we got here.
Mm. So I've got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Given that we've sort of seen these two characters evolve on screen, can Andrew really be great unless Fletcher puts him through these severe levels of emotional abuse? Is this what it takes for him to be great?
I believe so, because I believe that was the point of the film. There's no denying that Andrew was exceptionally good. I think that was always clear from the outset. He was exceptionally good. But to become the best, he needed to be pushed harder than those of his peers, because it's the only way to become the best is to be pushed a bit harder. Same as if you want the fastest car in the world. You've got to be willing to hold the pedal down until it goes 1 kilometre faster than the predecessor. If you don't do it, you don't get there. If you just stopped at the same speed as someone else, then you're only as good as anyone else. You're not better.
I'm so glad you finished off with an F1 reference.
Happy to help.
Well, look, given that this is a film about drumming and music and one's love and passion for such, what did you think about the actual film's music?
In terms of as a sort of an auditory experience or in terms of the visual execution?
Oh, both.
Okay, look, I think visual execution, I'll just start there because it is a film. I actually liked the way it was done. There was a lot of sort of close-up, dirty shots, like the bleeding hands, very tight frames, you know, sticks and beats and so forth. I think it was really nicely done. It was almost like you had this sort of pseudo-voyeuristic view of Miles, and at times also Fletcher. You kind of felt like you were living both their lives from time to time in the music rooms. And I really liked that because it felt a lot more engaging. And for a lot of people, you know, whether they like jazz music or not, as you said, the dynamic relationship between a teacher and a student isn't necessarily the most engaging thing in the world, and the music type also may not be the most engaging type of music for a whole bunch of people either. So I think the visual style to actually draw people in and give them that feeling that they're part of it sort of assists in selling the feel of the film, irrespective of what your personal opinions are on the music. But so far as the music itself is concerned, I actually liked it. Mm. Now, I don't necessarily feel, and this is just a personal opinion, that all of it strictly fell within the confines of jazz. I do feel that the drum solo towards the end of the film was overly long, ostentatious, parochial, and I didn't particularly like it. I think it probably would have been better being two-thirds of the length that it actually was, just because it felt a little bit wanky after a certain point. But I did like the music, and I did like that some of the music I actually believe may have been conducted by the composer for the film. I think some of it was actually original score. And I like that the sort of film had gone to that effort to actually produce some of these things. And I personally like jazz music, so I was quite okay with it. I think it was very well executed.
I like it how you went from parochial to wanky.
I have my moments.
Look, I'm not that musically inclined, so for me this was a very...
You like sports, don't you?
No. That's why I gave you... That's why I stood up for sports. I thought this film, like for me, someone who's watching it from like a film aspect, I was really enthralled and intrigued by this whole experience. Like my exposure to jazz, and when I started looking up or researching more into that type of realm, was after watching La La Land, surprisingly, and when, you know, there's a monologue about her, like the beauty of jazz. And I was like, oh, okay, here, this guy's making me go and look up more jazz songs and to understand and feel that monologue that he describes in that film. So, you know, I, as an amateur, as a novice, I thoroughly enjoyed it all.
And what did you think about the acting?
Mate, two phenomenal actors. And I personally liked Simmons a lot more than Teller, purely because I just felt that emotion, right? And and they were equally as good as each other, but Simmons just pushed it over the edge, because there's a line in the movie where he says, you know, the most two dangerous words in the English language are good job. Right, and it's his approach to this whole teaching tool, and you know, every kid gets a medal for participation, you know, and we hear that in a lot of comedy sketches as well. And there's moments as a viewer where I'm sort of thinking, has true talents been left to wither because they've been overwatered? But I think Simmons just perfectly captures, you know, that abusive degree of pressure, but and his mentality that the only way to produce a diamond is this unrelenting pressure. There's no other way. There's no other, you know, this is it. You can have shit, you can have coal, or you can have diamonds. But if you want diamonds, this is how I'm going to get it for you. And I think that type of tenacity, that tenacious personality that comes on screen, you know, because we've seen him scream. Right? We've seen him scream as the editor of the Daily Bugle in Spider-Man. But this was a different level of acting. And to have an actor who performs a similar emotion, but slightly nuanced, that is when you know what type of caliber they can bring on screen. Now for Miles Teller, man, I don't know if he can actually play drums, but he made me believe he could.
I believe he did play some of it, yeah.
Because this is just, you know, the way he sweats, the way he holds those sticks, that vigorous nature in his actions. It's almost like, man, if he doesn't, or if he didn't know how to play drums and he just learned it for this film, he was super convincing. It was almost like Riz Ahmed in A Sound of Metal. You know, it was that level of, oh, okay, you only sort of learned sign language for a couple of months? What? You know what I mean? So it was that level of perfection that he brought to the role.
Yeah, look, to my understanding, Miles Teller actually did do the drumming when we could see him doing the drumming. I believe he did have a double for some of it, but that, you know, 40 or 50% of what actually was in the soundtrack was performed by Miles Teller himself. So, yeah, I think kudos to him for actually learning how to drum like that. Like,
yeah,
whether he did all of it, some of it, or, you know, a small percentage of it, he was convincing in the role as a drummer, you know, doing a lot of this stuff. And I think that in itself was impressive. I've personally felt like, you know, his character was a little bit flat in its execution. Now, maybe that's the way it was meant to be, because he was meant to be this sort of quiet, sort of somewhat meek person, and that's fine if that's the way it was. Because I think at the end of the day, it was designed to juxtapose heavily against J.K. Simmons' character of Fletcher. And I agree with you. I think Simmons' execution of this was fantastic, and it kind of makes me feel like J.K. Simmons probably is a bit like that in real life, to be honest, because we see so many roles where he is like this. And I will admit, I did have a difficult time at points trying to actually separate him from editor of the Daily Bugle in Spider-Man, because I just kept sort of seeing some of that mannerism. But as you say, it was a little bit more finessed, it was a bit different, and he was a very believable sort of stern, strict teacher, as you say, trying to create a diamond under pressure. And I actually really liked him in the role. I think it fitted him perfectly.
Yeah, I think, and they both deserved that Oscar for that film, because they both were equally great in making that come to fruition.
Hmm. And I think another thing to, you know, mention here that's also important is that this wasn't a big budget film.
No.
I think this film was like $3 million, which in the world of Hollywood is a pittance. Like when your average film is probably anywhere from, you know, $30 to $80 million and higher for, you know, big blockbuster junk like Marvel, $3 million is insane. And it made something like $50 million in the box office, which ultimately on return on investment is phenomenal. Like, that's essentially Top Gun money at a different scale. You know, Top Gun might have cost $100 million to make and made $1 billion. This film cost $3 million and made 50. Like, it's that sort of success story. And I like the fact that, you know, not ignoring the fact that $3 million for the average person is still a lot of money. Let's not get away from that. But I like the fact that essentially these smaller budget films can be still so good. Like, having a good director and writer like Damien Chazelle, you know, to actually push this, as well as just a couple of really good leads. This didn't have a big cast, and it didn't need to have a big cast. I think, you know, it really is positive to see, and I think it'd be good if more of these sort of films were supported in terms of, you know, production companies actually making them, because there can be some really good things if, you know, executives of studios are actually discerning enough to find them.
Yeah. No, I agree.
But look, with that being said, what are your closing remarks on this film, and what do you rate it?
We've talked about how two phenomenal actors have brought these characters to life, and I was enthralled in the action. I was enthralled. I was gripped in the drama. It was a purely captivating film, to say the least, especially the climax scene, which, you know, we've talked extensively about. I could experience the tension, and it's highly deserving of the Oscar. And I'm going to give this film an 8.5 out of 10.
All right, fair call. So you're pretty much on par with the likes of IMDb and whatnot.
Well, call me Alan IMDb.
Look, I think I have to agree in large part with what you've just said. I think, you know, the acting was good, the music was good, the execution was brilliant. As I just said, you know, it was done essentially on a shoestring budget, and we got a really good film out of it. And I did like sort of depth that it went into, whether it be, you know, learning critique or what it takes to actually create someone truly brilliant and give them that extra push. I also like the fact that it created a bit of conflict and divide in what people thought about this film. Some thought it was absolutely abysmal, awful bullying, and other people went, no, I understand the point, irrespective of the bullying, without condoning it. So I'm actually going to give this film an 8.2.
Ooh, out of 10. Okay.
So I think we're pretty close. There's a couple little bits that I think, you know, could have been tightened up and I just would have liked. But on the whole, I think this was a very, very good film. And with that being said, that is all from us, folks, not just for this week, but that was also the last episode of Mess Explores. Thank you to our thousands of fans for listening over the last four seasons. We've thoroughly enjoyed analysing so many of your movies. Many we loved, some we outright hated. But it has been a pleasure going on this worldwide cinematic journey with you. So with that all being said, good morning, good evening, and good night.
Oh, mate, it has been a pleasure, Save. I wouldn't have done this with anybody else, and thank you to our fans. We wouldn't have come back week after week, fortnight out of fortnight, if it wasn't for you guys. It's been a sincere pleasure, and we look forward to seeing you in another form, hopefully in the near future. But until then, I hope we see you all shortly.